Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thanks for joining me, Tracy Ann Oberman, as we once more head into the dark corners of the underbelly of the internet. It's not the nicest place to go, I guess, but we do go there with some interesting and funny people. This week I'm joined by a journalist and a filmmaker who came on my horizon because his name kept cropping up and his tweets kept cropping up. And quite a few journalists, like Suzanne Moore, kept telling me that they loved this guy. And the more I looked into what he was saying, he'd obviously walked the walk, he'd obviously lived the life, and he knew what he was talking about. Nothing more fantastic on Twitter than somebody that knows their subject matter. He is called Oz Katerji.
Katerji. There you go.
And rather than me tell you about him, he's going to tell you a little bit. He's going to explain how he fits into this podcast. Hello, my love.
Well, I'm very, very pleased to be here. Thanks for having me, Tracy. You know, I've spent the last 10 years as a sort of struggling journalist who never really had any doors opened for me. So I'm one of the kind of new generation who managed to use Twitter as a platform. You know, I didn't get hired by a newspaper as a young columnist to build my name or anything like that. So I've had to use Twitter the same way, you know, 20 years ago I would use a newspaper column. So it's sort of I've managed to create a platform for myself on it, and I guess that's how I managed to
spread
my name.
Is that what got you on Twitter? Was that why did you come on Twitter?
I started an internship in a newspaper in 2009, and you know, the whole kind of idea about blogging or social media, you know, I used social media religiously at that age. Most millennials do, you know, I was a MySpace kid and then Facebook uni and yada yada yada. But the idea of putting just words out there on Twitter seemed really alien to me, and I signed up in 2009, but I didn't really get going on the platform till probably about 2012, 2013, then I started it using it more religiously. And you know, it's a platform that's full of really horrible people, but it's the only kind of main conduit for me to talk to
people. But you've, in my opinion, you've really impacted, because how come you know so much about the subjects that you talk about, which is the Middle East, which is Syria? You know so much about it.
So my father came to Britain as a Lebanese refugee from the Lebanese Civil War, and he met my mum out in Lebanon. Actually, who's British. She was a Red Cross nurse, and they were working together to help Palestinian refugees in Sabra and Shatila, Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon. They fell in love, and you know, then me and my sister were born from that.
Over there.
Raised here in the UK, but obviously, given my mother and father both, you know, worked in a war zone, my dad is from a former war zone, you know, I was always connected to conflict in the Middle East, and, you know, my sister and I both grew up in a very political household, so there was never really a chance for me to not mm-hmm. end up on the path. I mean, my sister's a nurse. You know, she's worked in Iraq and Palestine as well. So, the kind of it was my life, really, from childhood to now, is to be geared towards politics. And you know, some people grow up wanting to be footballers or astronauts. Or I mean, I wanted to be an astronaut for a brief period of time. But you know, from about the age of 8, 9, I kind of, being a war journalist was all I ever really wanted to do. So it was a childhood dream of mine. It helped that on my mother's side, she has a brother who worked the BBC, and he did some war journalism when I was a child. So I would watch my uncle on BBC News, you know, just sort of in awe, like, oh, I wish I could do that.
Well, so, did you remember the things he covered?
He covered Lebanon.
Did
the
you?
Lebanese so Civil War. So it wasn't, it was beyond, it was, you know, in the mid-90s that, right. that we're talking here. So after the kind of Israeli invasion of Lebanon. So it's sort of, it was kind of always my life goal to end up here. And in the last few years, you know, I've been on the ground covering Syria. I've been on the ground in Iraq covering the battle against ISIS. I've been to the Gaza Strip. I covered the Turkish coup d'etat. I covered violence in northern Lebanon. You know, I've been across the Middle East now, and I've spent, you know, the best part of a decade just focusing on that. And
that's the thing, though, Oz, is that you've actually been there. You've been there on the ground.
Yes.
Did you cover Kobani?
No, I didn't cover Kobani, not from inside Kobani.
Right.
I did cover it from the border areas, okay. But I didn't actually go in myself, which is unfortunate.
Because I found at the time, I remember being aware of that very early doors and being amazed that no, it wasn't a bigger story than it was. And was that because journalists couldn't get in?
No, actually, journalists could get in. The issue was, after the ISIS executions, it started becoming very difficult for freelance journalists to operate, because to get in, you need insurance and yada, yada, which is really prohibitively expensive.
Right.
Already the amount of money that you'd pay your fixer and your insurer and it is more than you'd be able to make back by selling footage or you know, work from inside the area. And also then employers stopped paying people to go into places. They would say, you know, I'm going to go into Syria. Sorry, we can't accept anything from you. Because it would be seen, if anything happens, that the employer is culpable or responsible for your safety, you know, in those areas. So even if you are freelance. So things became very difficult to sell your material, your content, as a freelance journalist, and became very, very much more dangerous than it had been, because you don't have the protections that you used to have. I haven't had very much money in the last few years. I've struggled in my career, so I haven't been able to go and self-finance and just go places like I hope to be able to do now.
So when you get sent into Gaza,
yes.
Was that something you did yourself?
Gaza, I was working for TRT, that's the Turkish state broadcaster, who themselves have problematic issues. I don't think I would ever work for them again. The money that it costs to cover something like that is no mean feat. You know, it costs a lot of money to be able to go places and afford the equipment. You know, I had a drone, I have a bulletproof jacket, I have a bulletproof helmet. Expensive camera equipment, all of this stuff, it costs a lot of money.
And who looks after you in these pretty lawless areas?
Actually, in Gaza, I was on my own. I had my fixer. So it was just me and my fixer rolling around. It was pretty good. I actually like working in small teams better than large teams. See, in Mosul, I was in a team of about maybe 15 people.
Who were you working for with Mosul? Amazing.
So, But in Gaza, it was just me and my camera.
But so. I think that's what's so impressive about you. And this series is called Trolled, and it's about being trolled. In your definition of a troll on social media, particularly Twitter, what would your definition be?
You know, I think the broader definition of troll is someone who is trying to get a reaction from you without any kind of, you know. My initial understanding of the word troll is that people are like practical jokers, the people that are doing things for their own entertainment. However, we've moved into a different kind of atmosphere now, in that people that are doing this kind of trolling, as it were, aren't just trying to, you know, I have friends that would, you know, troll other people. Like you troll right-wing pundits like Toby Young or whatever by, you know, taking his tweet and mocking something he says and trying to wind him up. that's trolling, as it were. But we've moved past that into a place where there's some very nasty bullying and targeted harassment. And I think sometimes that stuff falls under the category of trolling. And I think it's important to separate and distinguish between what we traditionally understood trolling to mean and what a troll is seen as. You know, the word has changed meaning over time. You know,
back in the day, if somebody had a go at you, you could just press, you know, block. Yeah. And the problem now is that you get dogpiled. People are working in movements. People are working to get enough retweets going that they can start trending. The thing as well about you is, having been in Gaza, Mosul, you've been on the ground, is how many tweeters I've noticed, I would call them trolls, tell you that you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are people. Firstly, I speak fluent Arabic. You know, I'm Middle Eastern. These are topics that I don't just kind of dip in and out of. You know, what you see my output on Twitter, often my opinion, isn't my work. You know, you don't see the studying that I do. You don't see the talking to people on the ground. You don't see the work that I do on the ground. You know, I'm a bona fide journalist. I work day in, day out, 12-hour, 14-hour shifts, whatever, you know, just doing journalism. So I think it's very easy to kind of look at my Twitter work and then say, well, that's what he does. He's just a blogger or whatever, when really I have a whole career outside of it.
Absolutely.
And Twitter is what I use to kind of boost that career, yes, as it were. And yes, there's a lot of Western entitlement about the Middle East, not about everywhere in the world, let's be fair. But, you know, especially being a Middle Easterner and talking about the Middle East, you get a lot of people who have no understanding of the language, no understanding of the culture, no understanding of the region, explain to you what's going on in your country or your region of the world because of some blog they've written by some asshole somewhere. And, you know, this is the same all over the world, unfortunately, but it's particularly heightened on the Middle East. Everyone has an opinion on the Middle East, and you don't need to know a damn thing about the Middle East to be able to get publish an article, an op-ed in The Guardian or whatever. And, you know, if you are a mainstream left-wing voice, you can be given an opinion on the Middle East, or a right-wing voice, let's be fair, even though you don't happen to have a clue what you're talking about. And this happens day in, day out. And these people have much larger platforms, mm-hmm, than people like myself do. And I suppose, how did I fall into your kind of, you know, how did you notice me? Yeah. Was because I had fucking enough of that. And I broke ranks with many journalists who just kind of use Twitter to tweet their articles and then walk away. I just had enough. And I just started arguing back with people that would publish things they didn't understand and then just walk away from.
Yeah.
You know, they make a blanket statement which is wrong, which spreads disinformation, and then they just walk away from it as in, well, great, next column next week now, without ever caring what the impact of those words are and how, you know, how that impacts people, how that impacts the political debate around something like Syria in this country, around refugees, around Israel-Palestine, around, you know, if people don't know their facts and they just publish opinion and then they aren't held accountable for those things, then you see the impact in the kind of narratives and attitudes you get from other people online that follow these people.
Exactly. The narrative becomes completely restricted, and that's why, and I hope you do get picked up by the mainstream media, because we need voices like yours that will burst people's echo chambers. Because I think that I'll sometimes watch and chip in with what you're saying, but, you know, I've noticed that what happened with me with trolls is it was about silencing a voice that they actually didn't want to hear.
Yes.
And they'll do that a lot through misogyny and anti-Semitism. But it's nasty. But with you, you're male, you're young, you're vocal, you're clever, and you've been there.
Mm.
And they're still trying to silence and discredit your voice.
They can't silence me. They try and discredit me and then they try and, you know, shut me down more than, you know. They don't engage, they block me, you know, which is, I'm blocked by a lot of people. And it's not like I'm... Let's be fair, I can swear occasionally, but I'm not particularly vicious or
nasty.
No, not
at all.
I will see something that someone says which is wrong, and, you know, if we want to do this, let's name names. Let's say people that are close to the Corbyn's leadership, people like Aaron Bastani, people from Novara, you know, Guardian columnists.
Seamus.
Seamus is kind of the kind of, yeah, you know, shadowy figure in the background now who deals with Labour's comms. Mm. So he's not dealing with day-to-day writing articles like he used to be. But Seamus has the same views that he always has had. But again, they will publish something which is rubbish. They will publish or retweet or boost war crimes deniers, people that deny crimes that I've studied, crimes that I've covered. You know, so the biggest ones being chemical weapons attacks in Syria. You know, then retweeting, you know, someone like Craig Murray, who's just a conspiracy theorist, a lunatic, who says, oh, maybe it was so and so that did it, with no evidence, no understanding of the case, publishing falsehood after falsehood after falsehood.
So let's say we can't say names for legal reasons,
fine,
but we could say Navarro. So a journalist from Navarro, say that. Say
yes. Okay. So, you know, you look at, for example, one of the biggest issues has been in Syria has been chemical weapons attacks. Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm gonna take my time to explain this because this is quite a big one, and it's to understand why it works this way. When we start with something like Syria, the idea of intervention in a foreign conflict, the idea of intervention in a foreign conflict is one that is very unattractive to the left, considering what happened in Iraq. Iraq, the issue there is Iraq was never an intervention. It was an invasion. It was there's a big difference between the two. Iraq wasn't currently going through, you know, a civil war, and civilians didn't require civilian protection measures at that time. You know, when you're talking about Halabja and things like that, very, very possibly they did. They needed a no-fly zone and so on. But the 2003 invasion wasn't about civilian protection measures. That's very clear to everyone. But the legacy of that has meant that any foreign involvement in any conflict is now Iraq. What about Iraq? You know, and we see this with attitudes about Libya, in which the UN Security Council mandated a no-fly zone to protect civilians from Gaddafi, after Gaddafi went on TV and said he was going to go house to house executing people for daring to stand up to him. So, you know, the UN Security Council came together and mandated a no-fly zone. So, and the idea with Syria has always been, well, if the Security Council do it, then you know, we should get involved if the Security Council do it. But the same people that say that about Syria are the same people that said we should never have got involved in Libya, despite the fact that it was UN Security Council mandated. The issue is they don't want intervention ever, no, under any circumstances, because they don't ever believe that it can have any positive role. That's not, you know, and that ignores the fact that you know, there was intervention in the Balkans to prevent genocide. You know, we have a history of doing it successfully, and we have a history of doing it badly. But to move forward as a society, you can't constantly live in fear of repeating the exact same mistakes, and especially if you're not even applying the lessons that we learned. Iraq is not Syria. It's never been Syria. There are very, very different cases. And talking about what happened in 2003 doesn't help understand what's happening today in 2019. Now, we understand chemical weapons attacks. I don't think there's anyone who would in the mainstream kind of political sphere in the UK that would ever, you know, justify or legitimize the use of chemical weapons. They're seen as being so barbaric that actually even people that are heavily against intervention can concede there might be a legitimate reason for military response to chemical weapons use, which is why it leads to conspiracism. Because as soon as you acknowledge that Bashar al-Assad uses sarin to murder children, you have to start conceding ground politically to people that think something must be done in Syria. So the very act of admitting the truth of what happened in Syria
means you end up having to agree with doing something
you
to
give,
intervene.
Or the way that some in the left see it, means you give succor to the interventionist argument. Same thing that happened with the Skripal poisoning. By acknowledging Russia's role in it, even by acknowledging it, you legitimize diplomatic or whatever response to Russia's aggression. Even by doing that, you're conceding that the this conservative government would be right to respond negatively to a nuclear armed power, or you know, it's a very complicated situation to be in. But that's why it breeds conspiracism, because if you are completely and utterly opposed to British military or heavy diplomatic involvement in foreign policy issues, then giving or providing a legitimate reason for that involvement becomes something that you don't want to do under any circumstances. So you're much more likely to believe that, you know, and this kind of conspiracism, it doesn't happen when Britain is seen as the aggressor.
Yeah.
Right. So in Syria, Assad has killed 95% of civilian deaths have been responsible. The Assad regime is responsible for them. But you still see people who claim to care about Middle Eastern lives, you know, denying hospital bombing, denying Assad uses chemical weapons, denying, because as soon as you do that, you open up a whole can of worms of what can should we do about it. But when it comes to Yemen, when a school bus is bombed by the Saudi coalition in Yemen, it's immediate condemnation. You don't start calling for investigations. I've never seen certain Guardian journalists
or Navarro
journalists look at a bus bombing, school bus bombing in Yemen, and turn around and say, well, before I have any opinion, we need the investigation. Actually, I'm hearing reports that it was the rebels that bombed their own bus and a false flag. You never hear this rhetoric around Yemen.
What would happen if you got a comedian in a room, you opened their Amazon account, and you look back at everything they've ever bought on that website? Well, this.
Because I was consuming so much peanut butter, I decided to try and get a powdered version that wasn't as fattening.
Your handwriting can change your life.
I regret this book. I regret this book.
Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that. I do have that on my fridge.
£4 you spent on that.
That's My Mate Bought a Toaster, available now from Great Big Al.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The trolling thing, which I find fascinating, is very few of the people that will approach you know anything about the subject.
No.
So they'll read their, you know, their...
Or they'll have been misinformed
or they'll be 140 log. Tweet, you know, 140 yeah. word character, their entire information, and yet they're obsessive. Let's say about, you know, about the Palestinians, and they'll just retweet endlessly, and they'll tell me, and I'm sure with you, that the things that you've seen with your own eyes are not true.
Yeah.
And that... You know, that this happens to people that are being bullied the world over. Their own truths are not their reality anymore. How do you deal with that?
I mean, it's very difficult because these conspiracists, some of them feel empowered by what they see as a false reality existing. You know, they see people that report on these crimes as being paid to do so by, you know, shadowy figures that are trying to, you know. So, and I saw Marlon Solomon's show the other day, a conspiracy theory, a Lizard's Tale. And he talked about how, you know, it's like being part of a club. You know, if you see the world existing in these parameters, mm-hmm. and you see, you know, you think that there's a grand conspiracy to fool people, you feel strengthened, emboldened, empowered. Like you have the knowledge to liberate people from their false consciousness. So I think I can understand the mentality that some of them genuinely believe they're fighting for the side of good. But
how does do you cope with it when you get told you're a shill? Because I mean, I don't know what your opinion, you know, I've never seen you, considering you are in Gaza, you were in Gaza.
Look, I think with a situation like Palestine is that I draw a line between caring for Palestinian people and falling into rhetoric that demonizes Jewish people. And I don't think it's even that thin a line, but I think Western anti-Zionism often bleeds into anti-Semitism because the tropes can be shared. You can replace the word Jew for Zionist and then get away with something because you're not talking about Jews, you're talking about Zionists, even though what you're saying is complete claptrap. My opinion of what's happening in Gaza is horrifying. What's happening in Gaza? I think that it's inexcusable. I think it's a crime against humanity. I don't mince my words on Israel's occupation of the Palestinian territories. I never do it, and I never have. But what I don't accept is my politics on Palestine ever excusing or you know, enabling people to have or get away with anti-Semitic rhetoric. And I look.
And yet on the back of that very measured response.
Yes.
You seem to get a lot of people calling you a Zio shill.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. It's that I don't identify as a Zionist.
No.
I would never call myself that. The biggest issue for me in that situation is the disenfranchisement and occupation of the Palestinians. My biggest focus is trying to win civil rights for Palestinians. So I've never ever, you know, I don't go around making arguments the case for Israel or anything like that. So I don't even, the only reason I'm ever targeted. In fact, the first time I ever got targeted and called a Zionist was because I was talking about Syria, because I was speaking out for the Syrian people. And because I was doing that, that was seen as being in Israel's interest.
My God.
And then therefore I was a Zionist. But actually, in reality, Netanyahu's position on Syria has helped strengthen Assad in parts. So
explain.
So
I mean,
I mean, look, this is a more complicated. There was an interesting article in Haaretz the other day about it. In that, Netanyahu has never really seen Assad as big an enemy as he does maybe say Iran. You know, Assad and his father before him haven't actually fired a bullet in anger towards Israel in many, many years. You know, it's kind of Netanyahu doesn't really give that much of a crap about suffering Syrians on his border, as long as it's not affecting the direct border area in the Golan. What Netanyahu cares about is the Israeli side of things, and he cares more about that than anything else. So no matter what that impact that has, including saying, well, you know, Assad's the least worse option for our security. You know, he's not the only person and leader in the Middle East that has this kind of attitude, you know.
The Saudis.
Well, I mean, look, the Saudis have made that kind of, the UAE have made that kind of...
Qatar.
Qatar less so. Qatar are more interested in their relationship with Iran, but they still foster links with quite hardline opposition groups within Syria. I mean, look, it's a mess. It's not like a good guys and a bad guys. It's not like there's a, when we're talking about leaders, as it were, rather than... it's why I never fall into that trap. Sure. I don't promote any leader over another. What I care about is civilians and protecting civilians who can't protect themselves. That's all that matters.
And that's
to me,
what so. You, I think that's what you get trolled for, because you will, they thought, in my observation of seeing how it played out with you on social media, they thought you were a voice that would align with them. And when you said, no, I'm going down my own path because that's what I want to talk about. You know, I've got a broad peripheral vision. I've been there. I've walked the walk. It was almost like nobody trusted you because you weren't going right. You know, you weren't black or white. Would you say that's true, that the nuance that you bring?
Yeah, you know, look, it's the problem is when you deal with politics is it nuanced. I mean, look, you get the same people who can understand nuance in other situations not being able to understand it here. You get people arguing that, look, Brexit was voted for by many people that are racist, and they hold racist views because they've been abandoned by austerity, you know, they've been abandoned by the government. So look, I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying I can understand why these people have racist views because yada, 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 yada. And to help them, we need to give them Brexit and we need to get rid of austerity and yada, yada. They don't use these attitudes to ever kind of understand why, if you've lived under a 4 or 5 decades of dictatorship, you know, and you're a working class or impoverished Syrian from a Sunni background, you might fall into a cycle of extremism in the middle of a civil war that's been raging for 8 years. You know what I mean? So it's like they look for perfection from Syrians. Well, Syrian civilians are getting a rough time, but you know, it's either Assad or the terrorists. It's kind of the, yeah, you know, decision they make in their head. The same people don't make those calls when it comes to Palestinians. Palestinians also have extremist groups within them. But that doesn't mean that they go, well, actually, maybe Israel should just stay in charge because, you know, if not Palestinian, you know, that's the argument you get from the Israeli right. The argument that you get from the Israeli right about why Palestinians shouldn't be given the vote or freedom is very similar to the argument you hear from the Western left about Syria and why they should, you know, Syrians shouldn't be given freedom because they're extremists, they'll kill everyone, they're Muslims, you know. It's the same rhetoric. Having covered all of these conflicts, it was very easy for me to start seeing these tropes being shared between. Here's an interesting one. The White Helmets, who are a group of medical volunteers who pull people out of rubble from buildings bombed by the Assad regime. That's their largest purpose in Syria. Now, the Western left started targeting the White Helmets after the Russian invasion of Syria. The Russians started bombing White Helmets ambulances and hospitals and so on. And instead of going, this is awful, medics are being killed, the Western left started going, well, are they really medics or are they actually Al-Qaeda? Actually, they're terrorists, so these ambulances are, you know, it's fine to bomb these ambulances, right? That attitude would never, ever, ever be permitted in any other conflict. But that dehumanization is seen as acceptable by the left on Syria, the equivocation of, you know, and whether or not people do it themselves, they are happy to engage with people that do.
What's the worst things that have been thrown at you by trolls on Twitter, social media?
I get people going through my social media, taking photos of my family, you know, putting them on the internet, taking photos of my, you know, my romantic partner, putting them on the internet. I get people miscategorizing my. One of the common tropes around me at the moment is calling me homophobe, despite the fact that I'm openly LGBT. You know, yeah. They call me a homophobe because of one comment I made about, I'm going to name who it was, about Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept. I am not a fan of his work. And in a conversation, someone said to me something and I responded with, Glenn should have stuck to gay porn. That's not a homophobic comment. Glenn used to run a gay porn company called Hairy Jocks. So
I don't know who Glenn Greenwald is.
Well, it's neither here nor there.
I like to think
my,
of
my
him
criticism
with his,
was you know
about his
it
job.
It was saying that he as a journalist, as it were, I don't respect his work, and that I think he was better off sticking to his previous job, which was running a gay porn company. That wasn't a homophobic comment. I was being very serious about that. But again, that's the one thing that needs to be screenshotted and then used. And I've seen it with you. You know, you were trying to have a conversation with a young girl who had beliefs that I don't agree with at all. And people started jumping on that and saying that you're a paedophile or you're, you know, that's what they do. They want to enrage you and misrepresent you and discredit you.
And yeah, no, totally. I criticised Netanyahu the other day about talking about appeasing the right. And next thing I know, you know, I'm a Nazi, I'm a right winger, yes. I'm a Zio, I'm a tax evader, all the crap that yes. we get. And then all the misogyny. But how does it make you feel when you get this doxing? And a doxing is when people try and out your private yes. life on social media.
Well, I mean, look, it's harder to dox me because people know who I am. What bothers me is anonymous accounts, you know, saying things that aren't true. What bothers me is the racism. I can handle people calling me an idiot or whatever. You know, I actually find it quite funny, people hating me. It really doesn't bother me at all. What I really hate is the racism. When people call me a jihadist or a terrorist or you know, I mean, it's just beyond belief to hear these things. And
is that coming from the right or just anyone?
Mostly it's coming from the left. Lovely, most of the Islamophobic abuse I get is from the left. Now, I do get it from the far right, especially in the wake of terrorist attacks, where I will make an effort to express solidarity and sympathy with the victims, and I will condemn extremism. Not that I feel like I'm compelled to, but because I'm horrified by what's happened, and I want people to know that these people don't represent me or my community as a British Muslim, and they never will. And that's when I will have the far right troll me and say, get out of our country, you know, whatever. But the most part is when I talk about Syria and stuff like that, I get people calling me a terrorist because I think that Syrians should live in a democracy. That's the long and short of it. I never make any justification for extremism. I think extremism needs to be purged from the earth. But still, it doesn't matter because the biggest thing is because I speak out in support of the White Helmets, I will get told that I'm Al Qaeda. And that, and not only that, I'm Al Qaeda in a grand conspiracy with Israel and you know, lizard people and whatever to you know, it's just utter.
How do you deal with trolls? Do you block them or do you engage?
I do the thing where I will respond and then block, so they can't respond back, but people can see from the thread that I'm not backing down, that I'm not going to just sit yeah. there and tolerate this stuff. I am gonna throw the last punch at least.
You've inspired me on that because I followed you a long time before I started to speak out, and I love the way that you were informed, but you would always come back. There's a certain journalist, let's say male or female, from Navarra, who yeah. I noticed doesn't have the same knowledge that you do.
No.
I don't think is Muslim, apparently doesn't identify as Muslim anymore. And you and he, you know, you'll challenge him, won't you, on things?
Well, yeah, I mean, let's be fair. I've been blocked by 85-90% of Novara contributors now.
Why is that?
Because they say ignorant things. They say ignorant things. They signal boost conspiracists and racists. And they don't have any accountability for it whatsoever. They don't feel, you know, that they their whole shtick is purity.
Absolutely.
Is being morally righteous and pure and everything. And you can't trust a Tory and you can't trust a Lib Dem because of austerity and whatever. But here, listen to this anti-Semite blame everything on the Jews. That's fine. You know, and I don't have to be accountable for that kind of rhetoric. I don't have to be accountable for smearing regular Syrians as being terrorists. You know, justifying the wholesale slaughter of Syrians by a dictator, you know.
So when you will go in and challenge with knowledge certain of those type of journalists, instead of, if they're journalists, surely they should be interested in what you say. Why are they so combative with you?
Well, because I guess I'm combative, but it's very easy to turn around and say, well, why would you listen to Oz? You know, he's aggressive. He, you know, don't listen to him. But the point is, they don't listen to anyone. It's not it's
unless
not
a, it's their own.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, it, but even their own, as soon as one of their own says something, say about Venezuela, who'll condemn Maduro or something like that, they'll turn on them and they'll say, "You know what you're talking about. You know, I'm disappointed in you. Yada yada yada." You know, it's a world view. So the idea that if I was politer with them, that they would listen to me in good faith, it's a lie, because there are many Syrian refugees living in this country who are beside themselves trying to combat this stuff, who are trying to get hurt, who don't have a fraction of the platform that I do. They're not listened to. They're not respected. No one goes, "I respect your opinion. I disagree with you, but I respect your opinion as a Syrian. Here, I'll have you on our podcast to talk about it." So again, people don't want to listen to me, but I've just had enough. I'm not willing to let them set the narrative without unopposed.
Has being trolled informed your work a bit more?
Yes, especially on anti-Semitism. You know, anti-Semitism is something that I cared about, you know, because I'm an anti-racist. But,
exactly.
But it's not something that I ever saw impacting my own life. And, you know, outside of the sphere of Palestine before the Arab Spring, which is most of my attention was focused on Palestine, some of the people that I would rely on for information, now looking back, I closed down my critical faculties in judging their words and behavior. And actually, Syria let me start seeing that the tropes they were trying to argue against were being deployed by them. They're constantly talking about the White Helmets being terrorists, right? And the same people that think they are really passionately caring about Palestinians are happy to target Syrian medics as being terrorists and justify their slaughter. However, what that leads to is people like Katie Hopkins. I'm going to name her here because she's a far-right troll. You can bleep out that name if you want.
Don't worry.
But Katie Hopkins has become a militant anti-White Helmet propagandist, justifying that, you know, because she's really, you know, she really likes Russian pro-Kremlin propaganda. She's really into that.
So this is the horseshoe effect of far right.
Right, yeah, but here's the thing. So they're very, you know, this whole anti-White Helmet stuff has come massively from certain Western journalists who consider themselves pro-Palestine.
Gee.
Who have passed this kind of anti-White Helmets justifying their slaughter to the far right. And then Katie Hopkins, about a year ago, during the Gaza protests when a medic was shot dead, Katie Hopkins turned it around and then started using the justification for killing the White Helmets for killing Palestinian medics, saying, "Well, they're Al-Qaeda, they're like the White Helmets, the Palestinian White Helmets." This is the rhetoric that Katie had borrowed from the far left and then started using it.
Wow.
You know, so and I push back and I say, this is Islamophobia. It's Islamophobic. It's targeting Muslims. It's smearing all Muslims as being terrorists. It's extremists. It lends into this. It's racism, pure and simple. But the far left refuse to understand that their targeting of the White Helmets and the rhetoric used around the White Helmets is exactly the same as the Islamophobia they pretend to protest when it's used to justify killing Palestinian medics.
And there we have political trolling in a nutshell on Twitter, because that's exactly it.
Well, it spreads from node to node to node. An astonishing thing to me is seeing how the left always prided itself on being pro-immigration, but how quick after the Brexit vote, you know, the so-called Labour left turned to British jobs for British workers rhetoric that they would have condemned from Brown, Miliband, etc., you know, several years beforehand.
Oz, where can people who are listening and myself find out more about you, your writing, your films?
You can follow me on Twitter at OZKATERJI. That's mainly where I put my stuff. Whenever I write articles, you can find me in the New Statesman occasionally. So I post everything up there. And, you know, sometimes I lose my patience a bit with the people that target me. So please forgive my stern words. But there is a purpose in everything that I'm doing. And it's trying to highlight some of the really damaging misinformation that has targeted different minority, vulnerable minority groups around the world.
And that helps you transcend trolling because the mission of what your message is more important than any personal hurt or slight.
Yeah, you know, it's not about me. And the only time it ever bothers me personally is when I'm targeted with racist abuse and people call me a terrorist of some kind, because it's just, I'm clearly not a terrorist. You know, I don't know many LGBT Islamic fundamentalists, to be honest with you. So, the idea that people that speak out for and in solidarity with the victims of some of the worst atrocities of the 21st century are targeted in this way, it's really quite despicable. And again, it's very easy for people in the mainstream to go, well, it's the far right that do this. Well, the far left are culpable for much of this too. And there needs to be a pushback and there needs to be accountability for the things people say on the internet.
I'm so delighted you came on, because to me you are a much needed and very wise voice of somebody that's actually been there. And I would far rather get my information from you, who's been there self-funded to go out on the ground and see these places and atrocities and form your opinion, than some bloke who's sitting in Liverpool who's never really been out of the city centre,
yes,
but reads all about it on, I don't know, some website.
Yes.
Your voice, it really cuts through. So thank you so much for coming
on
today.
Thank you for having me on.
And I think people should follow you on Twitter, because you're very wise.
Cheers.
GreatBigOwl.com.
My name's Pete Allison.
And I'm Dave Cribb, and we do a podcast called Friends with Friends.
Each week we invite a guest on, ask them to pick their favourite episode of Friends, and then we talk about it in far too much detail.
Basically, if you like the show Friends and you like it when people take things far too seriously, then you might well like this podcast. Search Great Big Owl on your podcast app of choice and you'll find Friends with Friends right there.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.